It's my pleasure to introduce to you E.W. Jackson. He's a bishop, pastor of a church, and he's also grown up in foster care and extreme poverty, and yet he persevered to the point that he graduated from Harvard Law School, a lawyer. He's also been in the Marine Corps. He ran for the U.S. Senate and a Republican nominee for the Lieutenant Governor of Virginia. And he's got a radio show. He's got a number of organizations that he started, STAND, which stands for Staying True to America's National Destiny. And the most important thing, I tell you, E.W. loves God, and he is not afraid to speak the truth, and he is qualified to speak on this subject. And I believe it's going to be a real blessing to you. So stay tuned for Bishop E.W. Jackson as he shares with you about socialism.
We're going to discuss one of the most important issues confronting our country, but it's one that is seldom talked about. We need to talk about it more because we've got to find a solution. And I want to begin by reading a quote. And while I'm reading it, you think to yourself, who might have said this? It reads, "The lessons of history confirmed by the evidence immediately before me show conclusively that continued dependence upon relief induces a spiritual and moral disintegration fundamentally destructive to the national fiber. To dole out relief is to administer a narcotic, a subtle destroyer of the human spirit." Now, there must be those among you who thought, that's got to be Ronald Reagan, right? Or perhaps some other conservative president that you can think of. Those words were spoken by Franklin Delano Roosevelt. And Franklin Delano Roosevelt is credited as being the author of the national welfare system in America. We want to talk about welfare today. How it works, what it's intended to accomplish, and unfortunately, what it actually accomplishes. Most people are not aware of the fact that the national welfare system really resulted from the Depression. Before the Depression, most care of people who needed help was done on the local level. Some government involvement, but a lot of churches, a lot of neighbors helping neighbors. There was no national system to help people who fell on hard times or having difficulty making ends meet. And to some extent, again, state governments got involved in the process because they were closer to the situation and could better assess what people might need. But there was no federal system. The national welfare system, and most people are not aware of this, the national welfare system actually resulted from the passage of the Social Security Act in 1935. Now, I say most people are not aware of that because we think of Social Security not as a welfare system, but as a system of helping people who have worked all their lives and contributed into a pot to draw from that pot in their retirement years when they don't have any income coming in from work. That was the way it was designed. That was the way it was intended. But just as we see in today's politics, even good ideas end up being burdened down with bad ideas because it is expected that the people in Congress, while they may not like the bad ideas, they don't want to not vote for the good idea and have that hung around their necks as a political albatross. Oh, you didn't vote for this. Well, I didn't vote for it because there were all these other things attached to it. That's often forgotten. And the big issue that they didn't stand with is what is remembered sometimes to their political detriment. Same thing happened with the Social Security Act. The Social Security Act included a national welfare system. And isn't it amazing that even Franklin Delano Roosevelt, the author of the New Deal, knew, or perhaps was pandering to those who knew, that there was something fundamentally wrong with a system that rewarded people for not working. and that gave them the sustenance that they needed to live without requiring anything of them. He called it a narcotic, a subtle destroyer of the human spirit. That started in 1935. And of course, it's only grown. Approximately $3 trillion was spent on the Great Society program of Lyndon Johnson. Today, we spend $1.2 trillion on welfare systems. And I'm not talking about Social Security, folks. I'm talking about welfare, a variety of programs that we have in our country now to help poor children, to help single women who are raising children, to help with housing for the poor. There's a whole system now that costs the American taxpayer $1.2 trillion a year. Now, as Christians, we are required to show love and compassion to our neighbor. We're required to do what we can to help others. You know, the Bible says that if your neighbor comes to you and is in need of food and clothing, and you say, be warmed and fed and send him on his way, and you don't give him the things that he needs, what good have you done him? So Jesus makes clear that we're supposed to be generous. We're supposed to be givers. We're supposed to be people of compassion, people who care about our neighbors. Here's the distinction that we all need to understand. When I give to someone out of the goodness of my heart, because that person is in need, and frankly, out of the grace that God has shown me, because I don't want to imply that somehow I'm so good, but out of the grace that God has shown me and instilled in me, and I give to others, that's true compassion. But when the government orders me or by force takes from me what I've earned to give to others that it considers to be worthy of what I've earned, that's not compassion, that's compulsion. And this is where many people on the political left have gotten completely off track, which is why the data tends to show that people on the political left who believe that government ought to do everything tend to be, generally speaking, tend to be very stingy with their own money. Whereas Christians who really believe in the principle of personal responsibility, that every person ought to do for his or herself, tend to be the most generous people in the country because we want to help others, we want to give. But once the federal welfare system was created, more and more the need for individuals to step in with compassion was substituted with government stepping in with compulsion and with concepts like wealth redistribution. We've got to take from those who have to give to those who have not. Here again, when I stick my hand in my own pocket and take out something to give to someone because I care about that person, love that person, want to help that person, that's virtue. That's great. But when someone else sticks their hand in my pocket and takes out of it to give to someone they consider to be worthy, that's not virtue, that's vice, that's theft. And the whole welfare system, sadly, is built on that principle. Now, here again, people will say, well, that's selfish and you don't want to help others. No, because we want to look at the consequences of the way this system has worked so that we can really determine, are we helping others or are we in fact hurting them? Franklin Delano Roosevelt, even though I think we credit him with being the architect of the national welfare system that plagues us today, he himself pointed out that it was very, very dangerous to turn people into dependents, because once that happens, you sap them of their own sense of personal responsibility and initiative and ambition and desire to accomplish something in life. And unfortunately, we have done that in a horrible way. These are devastating statistics. The left often points to, and by the way, welfare is something that has hurt communities across the board. I don't want you to think that this is racial, but because there's a disproportionate number of Americans of African ancestry who are poor, right now the number's about 33%, about a third of the black community lives in poverty, then obviously the national welfare system is going to have a disproportionate impact on them. But it has a terrible impact on any community that ends up depending upon it to any large extent. And the most devastating impact it has had, in my view, is the destruction of the family. It has destroyed families from every demographic and every background. In 1965, when we began to measure these things, we were able to take a look back about 10, 15 years. In spite of poverty, in spite of much more invidious and open racism in various parts of the country, 85% of black children, some put the number at 87% of black children, were born in married, two-parent, monogamous families and raised in those families. From 1950 to 1965, the number of children born out of wedlock increased by only 2% in the black community, by only 2%. 1965, the Great Society programs were passed. The welfare system took on a gargantuan scope that it hadn't had even during the Depression. And at that point, it begins to implement policies that have had a devastating impact on families across the board. Here again, disproportionately impacting the black community, but it's impacted Americans of every background, of every ancestry, Americans of European descent, Americans of Hispanic descent, Americans of African descent. Anywhere a community gets caught up in the welfare system, it has devastating consequences on the family. So 1965, 85%, about 85% of black children born in wedlock. Again, there are some studies that say, well, no, it was probably about 75%. Fine, take 75%. Within a matter of years, that number was halved. From 25% of children born out of wedlock, if you want to use the 75% born in married families in 1965, say 25%, to by 1990, 64% of black children are born out of wedlock. Today, and it varies to some extent from community to community, for a number of years, the number was 72%. I am now reading literature that's saying it's up to 75% of children born in the black community are born out of wedlock. Fully 70% of children in the black community are raised in single-parent, female-headed households. Now, by the way, to show that this impact has not simply been on the black community, in 1965, only 3% of white children were born out of wedlock. The number is now somewhere between 33-35%. And here again, in some communities, in some areas, worse. For example, in Richmond, the number of black children born out of wedlock is 80%. And you say, well, wait a minute, this is what the left has been saying all along. Well, that has nothing to do with welfare. That goes back to slavery. Folks, that is an absolute lie. It's simply a lie. It is simply something that is used to try to cover the devastating impact of the welfare system on the black community and others. When slavery ended, the black family was largely intact. Now, we don't have exact numbers. And people will say, well, yeah, but families were broken up by slavery and so forth. That is simply not true. Studies done by scholars like Thomas Sowell and Walter Williams have shown that, yes, about 16% of black families during slavery were broken up. But remember that there was a tremendous incentive to hold families together because it made people happier. It made them less likely to try to escape. It made them less likely to be recalcitrant and rebellious, because taking away somebody's wife or husband or children was likely to have a devastating impact on their attitude. And slave masters soon learned that it's so much easier to deal with them if their families are intact, because they make for happier, more contented people. Many of the escapes from slavery were escapes by people attempting to go find the loved one that had been taken away from them. So about 84% of black families remained intact during slavery. Now, I'm a perfect example of that. My great-grandparents were slaves and sharecroppers in Orange County, Virginia. And my great-grandfather, Gabriel, married my great-grandmother, Eliza, while they were slaves. When slavery ended, they remained together, and they raised my grandfather, all of his siblings, and they remained married until my great-grandfather died in 1884. They remained married. And that was the case across the board. In fact, for those who had been separated when slavery ended, they often went searching for and found their estranged wife or husband and reconstituted their families. Black families remained intact in the worst circumstances imaginable, in slavery. And then after slavery and after Reconstruction, which gave us a respite from some of the racial oppression that was going on, particularly in the South, they still remained together. And think about this. 100 years later, if you use the low number, 75% of black children are born and raised in two-parent monogamous families. That's 100 years after slavery is over. That takes you right through Jim Crow, right through the worst circumstances of the racial climate in our country, and yet the black family remained intact. And in 1965, it's like falling off a cliff. You see the decimation happening. Well, why? How does the welfare system create this? Well, the welfare system incentivized single-parent households by giving women more money if there was no man in the home. And so if you had more children, you got more money. If there's no husband in the home, no father in the home, you got more money. And of course, once you start that cycle and men lose their sense of worth because they're not needed, the government takes care of it. There are plenty of other draws and attractions for their time, their attention, the streets. Look, and I'm not saying welfare is responsible for all of this. I really do believe that the data proves that it's responsible for most of it. But remember, too, that after World War II, there was a great migration of black people from the South. Remember that up until, I think, World War II that period, 90% of black Americans lived in the South. 90%. There are very few black Americans living in the North or the West or other parts of the country. With that great migration, they left agrarian society and moved into urban society. And of course, that has its own temptations and problems and issues. And people were facing a lot of choices that, frankly, they didn't have in a more rural community. But welfare only exacerbates that. Because now a woman doesn't need a man in the home. She can get her subsistence through the government. And the man, frankly, is in a position to run the streets. Now, there have been attempts over the years to try to correct that by, in some cases, locking men up for non-support. I'm not sure what that accomplishes, because they certainly can't support their family while they're locked up. But I understand the motivation behind it, because there's this sense that this person is not fulfilling his responsibility to his own family and is putting that responsibility on us, on society at large, and there ought to be some punishment. There ought to be some consequences for that. I'm just not sure that that worked. So you've got men, instead of working and taking care of their families, and they're off doing other things, Because after all, the woman can be taken care of without that. And here again, that happened. It's happened in Hispanic families. It's happened in white families, in black families. It's happened across the board. And it's been happening for a long, long time. When my children were in elementary school, before we took them out of elementary school and put them in Christian schools, we kind of did an informal poll. And we learned that even though the school was predominantly Americans of European ancestry, because the community was, it was a suburban community, we didn't live in the city, we found that the overwhelming majority of children in that classroom had no fathers in the home. That was a suburban community. So this stuff, these horrendous policies that I have no doubt for some were very well-intentioned. For some, I think they had very good motives, but they forgot the law of unintended consequences, which means you better think about what the long-term impact of the policy will be, not just how it will make you feel. It might make you feel good, but it could have devastating impact on the people who you claim to want to help, and that's exactly what happened in this case. And it's helped create this major problem we have in our country, a family breakdown. And you and I, taxpayers, are paying $1.2 trillion to perpetuate a system that is really undermining the most fundamental institution of our culture, which is the family. Now, I said I think many people were very well-intentioned. And I'm not ascribing evil motives to everybody who's been involved in this process. But we do know from the record that Lyndon Johnson and his Great Society program had a very demeaning attitude toward black folks and saw the Great Society program as a means of corralling them politically. And as he said, making sure that they would vote for Democrats for the next 200 years. And he didn't say it in nearly as genteel the way I've just said it. So not everybody who did this thought this was going to be some great, compassionate, liberating thing to help people. He understood the political implications, and I think he understood exactly what Roosevelt understood. We can make them dependent, and we can control them for the foreseeable future. And sadly, that's exactly what's happened. The Democrat machine is built largely on the welfare system because you have people captive in welfare-type housing projects, poor neighborhoods. There's really nowhere for them to go. They're dependent upon you to make sure you perpetuate these subsistence payments that they're getting. And you promise that you're going to save them from the racists who want to take everything from them. And it really is part of the political machine that is keeping a whole group of people captive to poverty and crime and violence and decrepit housing and poor education and all of the indices that we all see in the news every day happening across our country in the inner cities of our nation. But nothing I've said to you really captures the most devastating consequence. Because the most devastating consequence is happening to the children of these homes that are now fatherless and have been fatherless now for, two generations. Since the 1960s, more and more and more and more and more children raised without fathers in the home. Now, I think that I am emblematic of both the problem and the solution. When I was born, my mother and father were breaking up. Their marriage was pretty much over. And at the age of 17, 18 months, I was placed in foster care. My father was working full-time, couldn't take care of me, and my mother was simply nowhere to be found. And I ended up in foster care, and I was in foster care for 10 years. Up until the age of 10. By the time I was in those adolescent years, 9, 10 years old. I was already in a gang. I was already committing petty crimes. I was already ignoring any educational responsibilities at all. I went to school when I felt like it. And my gang and I, we hung out in the streets instead of going to school. And the people that we admired in our neighborhood were the people who had gone to jail and come out buffed and tough. And we weren't looking up to doctors and lawyers. We weren't looking up to astronauts. We weren't even looking up to sports figures. I mean, they were distant from us. But it was that guy who had been to jail and done hard time who came out and paraded up and down the streets and had people look and say, oh yeah, he went to the penitentiary. That's the person that we looked up to. It's cultural pathology, I call it, when you have a situation in which the person who ought to be your primary role model, your dad, is not there to show you what a real role model is. Now, I knew who my father was. Unlike some, you know, we've got people in our country now, they've never met their fathers. They don't even know who they are. I knew my father. He visited with me. And I wanted to desperately live with my father. And I can tell you that what I remember. By the age of 9 and 10, you know, you have enough self-awareness to know how you're feeling. And I can look back on that and share that with you. I remember feeling unloved. I remember feeling that, well, there must be something wrong with me because my mother and father aren't here to take care of me. And so I don't know what's wrong with me, but I know one thing, nobody's going to tell me what to do. If my mother and father aren't here to tell me what to do, nobody's going to tell me what to do. The police aren't going to tell me what to do. My foster parents aren't going to tell me what to do. Nobody's going to tell me what to do. And one day, when I was 10 years old, I'd almost failed out of fifth grade. I remember the conference that my foster mother had with my fifth grade teacher where she was explaining that I'd been in school so seldom that year that they might be forced to keep me back. I'm not sure why I was not kept back. But my father showed up that summer, and I can remember it as if it were yesterday. I was hanging out on the street with my friends. And he rolled down the window of his car and caught my eye and pointed at me and told me, come here. And when I went up to the car, my father said this to me. He said, you've always said that you wanted to live with me. Because whenever I would see my father, I would say, well, Dad, why can't I live with you? Why can't I live with you? I said, well, son, you know, you just can't. He said, but you've always said that. He said, you still want to come live with me? I said, yeah, Dad. He took me to my foster home, told my foster mother that he was taking me to live with him. And I won't go into the details, but it was a terrible scene because she became hysterical. Because imagine, she had raised me from 17, 18 months. I was her baby. But my father said, if I don't do something, we're going to lose my son. Because he saw what was going on. And folks, literally, overnight, my life changed. My father imposed discipline on me. He gave me a vision. And by the way, I don't mind saying, my father never instilled in me this sense of hopelessness that America's a racist place and you can't make it in America. Nobody can do anything in America. My father used to say to me, son, this is a country where you can do anything you want to do, but you've got to make it happen yourself. Nobody owes you anything. You got to earn it. I expect you to do well in school. I expect you to stay out of trouble. I stopped hanging out with my gang. I had limits on how far I could leave from the home without his explicit permission and awareness of where I was going, whereas before I'd run the streets and went wherever I wanted to. And folks, overnight, my life changed. This issue of fatherlessness is bringing us devastating consequences. I've already told you, I felt unloved, I was rebellious, I was angry. And in that sense, I've got the utmost sympathy and empathy for these kids that are running the streets right now in gangs, because I know where that anger comes from. I once had it. And this welfare system that we've created, you have to say this in just these explicit terms. It has been and continues to create the monsters that are plaguing the streets of our inner cities, hurting many people who are just trying to live, the law-abiding citizens, kids on their way to school getting shot in the crossfire, women out trying to shop, having bullets fly through their cars and kill them and kill their children. Do you realize in just the year 2020, more black men were killed in street violence across the cities of our country than were killed in all 13 years of the Iraq War. In fact, twice as many in 1 year. The inner city doesn't have a police problem. It has a fatherless problem. This is just a few of the statistics as to what this is accomplishing. And this is coming from the Bureau of the Census and from the Center for Disease Control and a number of other sources. But fatherless homes produce 63% of youth suicides. In other words, 63% of the youth who commit suicide come from fatherless homes. 90% of runaways come from fatherless homes. 85% of all children treated for behavioral disorders are from fatherless homes. 71% of all high school dropouts are from fatherless homes. 75% of adolescent drug addicts. 70% of juveniles in youth correctional facilities. 85% of all youth offenders who graduate to adult prison are from fatherless homes. 60% of the prison population is from fatherless homes. 80% of convicted rapists from fatherless homes. 72% of adolescent murderers, fatherless homes. Children from fatherless homes are 5 times more likely to commit suicide, 10 times more likely to abuse drugs, 20 times more likely to suffer from serious mental illness, 20 times more likely to do hard prison time, and 14 times more likely than a child from a two-parent family to commit the crime of murder. That's what the welfare system in America has produced. And here again, that applies not only to the black community, but it applies to every community in this country that is being devastated by the consequences of incentivizing men staying out of the home and women living off the government. Now, that's the circumstance we are in right now. And by the way, it has political implications, as I've already explained, because the machine politics of the Democrat Party really depend upon this. That's why you don't hear of any reforms being instituted to require work or figure out how to rebuild a family and create stable homes in these communities. You don't hear that because it serves a certain political class. You know, Bill Clinton, Democrat, to his credit, reinstituted work requirements for welfare while he was president. He famously said, "The era of big government is over." Now, I don't know whether he was pandering to the fact that he had to deal with the Republican Congress or whether he really meant that in his heart. I don't know. But he was right. Barack Obama came in and eliminated all work requirements. Now, the Bible says, from a Christian perspective, if any would not work, neither should he eat. That's pretty straightforward. And the word also says, he that does not care for his own household has denied the faith and is worse than an infidel. So the Bible puts a very high premium on personal responsibility. You might say to him, "Bishop Jackson, but what do we do when a woman has no one to take care of her and she's got young children to take care of? How in the world do we deal with that other than sending her a welfare check?" Well, I think we've got to figure out a way to disengage the federal government from the process. And that can't happen overnight. I realize that. But here's part of what is required. Number one, I don't believe that anyone who is able-bodied in the United States of America, male, female, nobody who is able-bodied in the United States of America, should be on a perpetual dependence on a welfare check. They should be required to work their way out of it. everybody ought to have to work. So what about a woman who's just had a baby? Fine, give her some time to take care of her baby. But then we need to do everything that we can to support going to work. Other women do it. My wife is particularly committed to this idea that women should stay home and take care of their children when they're young. And I agree with her. But you can work part-time. Let's figure out a way to provide daycare for those who want to work. But all we are doing is perpetuating intergenerational poverty. Now, I realize these things are not easy because, look, it's very easy to create these systems. It's very hard to work your way out of them. But that's number one. There's got to be a work requirement for any able-bodied person. Now, people who are mentally ill and they simply can't take care of themselves. And by the way, there are a lot of people who are handicapped who still can work. And those people ought to be required to work, not out of a sense of hardness toward them, but out of a sense of wanting them to experience their own human dignity. The sense that they can contribute to their own sense of well-being. I mean, there are programs now that put people to work who suffer from, you know, a variety of mental illnesses or handicaps, but they're able to do something. Let them do it. But we can't perpetually take care of people because, in my view, it is morally wrong. In fact, I have to say this, folks, and I know this is going to seem a bit hard or harsh, but I believe this with every fiber of my being because I've witnessed it. I just described what my life was like growing up. I grew up in the inner city. My wife and her family lived in the projects. My mother-in-law got a job as a practical nurse. My father-in-law went to work for Sunship Building and Dry Dock Company. They worked their way out of the projects. They bought a home. Nobody did it for them. They did it on their own. But when I was growing up, I knew many families that were in the projects all their lives because they had housing that was practically free and they got a check that allowed them to do it. In fact, I dare say, folks, I dare say, and here again, this is not based on some book I've read. This was my life. That the whole welfare system was supporting drug dealers because some of the biggest drug dealers in the community were living in the projects. Their woman collecting a welfare check, them not acknowledging that they were actually staying in the place, and they were dealing drugs out of the project apartment. We're perpetuating a monstrosity. You gotta work. Everybody who is able-bodied needs to work. Here's the second thing I would suggest. And here again, folks, please understand where I'm coming from. I am not a scholar who has simply read a bunch of books on this stuff. I have read a lot of books on it, and I do study the issue because I do want to know what the scholarly material says. And I just think people like Thomas Sowell and Walter Williams have an immense amount to contribute if we would lay aside the politics and just listen to these men. And there are others as well. They just happen to be two of my favorites. But listen to these men who have written so powerfully and eloquently and cogently and compassionately about these issues. This is not about being hard on people or being against people. This is about being for people, wanting the very best for them. What we ought to want and what we ought to have is a system that wants people to fulfill their highest potential, that wants them to get out there and take the gifts that God has given them and put them to work. See, this is part of the problem too, because the architects of this new modern welfare system, generally speaking, and here again, forgive me for the generalization, I realize there are probably exceptions, But generally speaking, they're godless. They don't believe that we ought to depend upon God for anything. The government is God. The government will do it. And as a result, they don't understand that each human being, including that welfare mother who's had four children and no men who stepped up to take responsibility, has gifts and talents and capabilities that need to be unleashed and can make a contribution to our country, to our community, to our family, to the world. One of my best friends is Star Parker. Star Parker started out as a welfare mom. Star Parker now runs one of the premier think tanks in the country, CURE. And she is helping to develop solutions to these problems because here again, she, like me, she's not so much a scholar, even though she has a think tank now, but she's experienced this. She knows what this is. And she knows this is not compassion. This is captivity. And that people need to be released from it. I knew people when I was growing up, and their fathers were not there to rein them in. One of my dearest friends, Herman Cooper, I don't know whether Herman Cooper's out of prison now or not, but he went to jail for killing another friend of mine. Wasn't close to this guy, but he went to jail for killing him. Herman Cooper had been a member of my street gang. We knew the people around us who were taking advantage of the dole, thinking that they were, quote unquote, getting over, when in fact they were going under. Now, my dad, I can't give him enough credit. I really can't. Because even though he lived in that world, God somehow gave him a wisdom beyond his education, even beyond his level of spirituality at the time. My father came to Jesus Christ later in life, but he still believed in God. He just wasn't a servant of Jesus Christ. He hadn't surrendered his life to Jesus Christ, been born again and filled with the Holy Spirit, but he respected and honored God. And my father used to say this to me. He used to say, son, nobody owes you anything. You work for what you want. You go out there and make a life for yourself. And he used to warn me, he said, and look, you're gonna come across people who will be against you for whatever reason. He never got into this obsession about, oh son, they won't let you, the white man won't let you, and the government won't let you, and the system won't let you, and all of that. He said, look, there will be people against you for whatever reason. And he said, now you go over them, you go under them, you go around them, or you go through them, but you don't let anybody stop you from accomplishing what you want to try to achieve in life. He said, and this is the thing I always want you to remember, and I never forgot this. He said, there will be people who see that you're trying to make something of your life, and help will come from unexpected places. People you never expected to help you will help you. People you never thought would do anything for you will come alongside you. And I didn't understand it at the time, but my father was teaching me the goodness of America. He was teaching me that, boy, this country has its problems, yes. But it's a place of opportunity and hope, no matter who you are. And I later learned where this optimism came from. My father was a hobo during the Depression. And you know, hobos weren't homeless people or bums, as we would refer to them in colloquially now. But hobos were actually people who were out of work as a result of the Depression and went and rode the freight trains from town to town trying to find work. And my father would get on those trains with people from every background. I mean, it didn't matter. The color of their skin didn't matter. They were all in the same boat. They would get off the train sometimes, and my father said, we would sometimes cross the yards of people who were doing better as we were heading into town, trying to find some kind of day work or something. And my father said, there were people who would put, they knew we were coming, and they would put sandwiches out. He said, I never had anybody say, oh no, we don't feed you, you're black. They knew we were all Americans, we were all in trouble, and there was a camaraderie among us. See, people can always point to the problems. They can point to the imperfections. They can point to the horrible mistakes that have been made in our country because we're human beings. But how about pointing to the virtue and pointing to the glory and the nobility that our country's also demonstrated? As I didn't realize it then, but my father was instilling me a sense that you live in a wonderful place and don't get focused on the bad people who might want to do bad things. Remember, there are good people who want to do good things. And if they see you want to do good things too, guess what? They'll help you. They'll be with you. We've got a welfare system that's based on the idea of hopelessness and despair. Oh, there's no opportunity for you. Nobody will let you. I met with a group of young people when I was a pastor, young guys who were kind of, they were in the streets. And I'm serious, folks, here again, these are my experiences, not what I read in a book. And you know what they said to me? They said, well, we have to deal drugs because the white man won't let us do anything else. And I looked in the eye, I said, really? I said, so how does that work? Is he going home with you to stop you from doing your homework? And when you try to do your homework, he slams the book and says, I'm not letting you work. I'm not letting you learn. And they kind of looked at me. I said, is he stopping you from going out and looking for a job? Is he stopping you from shoveling snow in the winter for your neighbor for a few bucks? I mean, explain to me how it works. And they just kind of looked at me as if I had two heads, because they didn't know what they were talking about. They've heard that garbage from Jesse Jackson and Al Sharpton and a bunch of race-baiting hustlers, and they've imbibed it, and it becomes an excuse for every kind of destructive behavior you want to engage in. We've got to require that anybody who is going to collect welfare has got to work. And here's the other thing I've mentioned, because I'm getting close to time where I'm going to have to stop. But we've got to train young men who father children. And I'm not sure how we do this. Here again, folks, I can cite you instances. I could point the finger at particular people. I'm not going to name names. Who have multiple children, men who have multiple children and aren't taking care of any of them. So here again, this stuff is not theoretical. And these poor children are growing up fatherless, and often the people doing that, their fathers are in prison or have just ignored them. We've got to start retraining men how to be fathers. When I say we, I mean we as churches have got to start retraining men how to be fathers. We as a society have got to start putting a premium on fatherhood. I mean, all of this gender-bending craziness that is going on has got to stop. How can you teach a man to be a father when the first thing you want to tell him is he doesn't even know whether he's a man? Or he might be a woman on the inside. I mean, this is craziness. And for communities like the Black community, the Hispanic community, which also has a problem, not as bad as the Black community, but it has a problem too with fatherless homes, to be instilling this kind of stuff in communities that so desperately need to have fathers in the home is like committing suicide. Well, look, I hope this has been helpful to you. I hope it's been encouraging to you. I'm not exactly sure how we're going to solve these problems. I believe that the government is going to have to take the back seat and watch the private sector do it. But unfortunately, I see the corporate world buying into a lot of political correctness that is the antithesis of what is really needed in these inner cities. Pouring money in is not the answer. There needs to be cultural transformation. And that's got to come through the churches. Churches have got to step up and stand up and speak up. Look, I am a product of a dad who loved me enough to step in and take me out of a situation that was going to lead to my destruction. It wasn't a welfare system. It wasn't a government program. It wasn't midnight basketball. It was a loving father. And if we can get fatherhood to take front and center again in our country and get men taking responsibility for their children, marrying women before they fire their children, A lot of the societal problems that we're having today would completely disappear, and the numbers of people that we have in prison today would begin to decline dramatically, because the problem is really not racism. The problem is the breakdown of the family. And by the way, only Christians and churches know that, because we know that God created the family as the primary place for teaching people how to live. That's what we need to come back to. And so I hope that you'll find a way that you can get involved in this effort, because it may be the very thing that is ultimately going to save the United States of America. God bless you.
I think we forget the cost of freedom, that this freedom came at a cost, and that there are many lives that have been given over how many hundreds of years so that we can enjoy what we have today. So when you forget the cost of something, you take it for granted, and it's easy to give it away. And I think that's what's happening. I think Americans have forgotten the cost of freedom, especially the younger generation has forgotten the cost of freedom and has forgotten how thankful, you know, we need to be for what we have.
So basically, people under communism surrender everything that they have, their strength, their will, their talents, their desires and everything to the government. They wanted them to take care of them to the best ability, but the government was not interested to take care of them.
I think that it's not correct. If you go to like another country to live, you should to follow the rules. You should to be legal citizen. You should to legally work, pay taxes, and be like right citizen. Because like, if you want to live in this country and get rewards from that living, you need to pay back. You need to be responsible and bring wealth to this country as well.
What the socialism does, it makes people depend on the government. We'll give you food, we'll dress you, we'll give you health, but this is what you gotta do for us.
By the way, socialism is a scam. They're not going to be able to keep those promises. That's the bait.
It gives you almost opportunity to think, well, you know, maybe we could have a better society, or maybe we could do things differently, and have really forgetting that how good it is where we are.
A lot of people, they want to come to U.S. and stay here, but they want to bring their own culture, their own like background from the countries from which they actually want to escape.
I don't buy into conspiracy theories. I'm not denying the coronavirus is real, but I see they've used it to their advantage. And what it's done, it's taken away people's livelihood. So now they're dependent on the government. And for socialism and communism to work, you must develop a dependency on the government.
What I see happening is fear is being used through COVID, through that agenda, to bring more government restrictions and government controls. Government becoming your savior, so to speak.
The mindset is government will provide for me, and I have nothing, and I don't have to do anything. The mindset that government will do everything for, government will take care of me. The promise of government to take care of me. Unfortunately, it keeps you behind. Like you become, you're not moving forward. You actually start to move backwards.
Nobody did anything, because what's the incentive? What's the incentive if the government is going to take everything from you? Why? They're taking care of you, so why should you be motivated to do anything? And so that was, what we were used to.
People say, well, this isn't such a bad thing. Wait a minute, you know, they're just giving us all these payments and I can get more money from the government than I can working. So, you know, I might as well just stay home and the government can take care of me.
You know, that was the norm. Not until I came to the U.S. that I knew what real freedom was. And, you know, it's so sad to see where this country is headed. It's really, really, really tragic. And to watch people just sit back and let it happen, I'm like, how is this happening? How is this happening? Why are people not doing anything about it?
So when they see something working, they don't want to let go of those controls. They just want to bring people under more submission, really, is what's happening. That's what I see happening here. When that dependency becomes the norm, then the government is able to use other things to bring, you know, to bring fear with something else.
It's happening so fast. It's like breakneck speed. We're headed in that direction. And it's terrifying.
Now there's the threat of different kinds of COVID. You know, there's different kinds of strains. It is just a vehicle for bringing in government controls and people's dependency on the government.
Money don't come from air. Money has to come from somewhere. And unfortunately, during the socialism and then to the communism, money is gone. Government say we cannot provide. Government doesn't have money because nobody makes money in socialism, communism. Everybody's like all for one and one for all.
So they think that the government is their sort of, you know, you can help me out here. I'm not getting the job that I want, so maybe you can give me some payments. And that's why socialism, I think, is a lure for young people especially. They don't necessarily want to work as hard to get it. And they want the government to come to their rescue.
They're forcing people into poverty so they can become dependent on the government. And people are actually doing it. They're like, where's my check? And people think this is good.
Government will provide for you anything. They provide you food, bed, medical support, and place to live. Why do you need money? You don't need money. We'll provide for you.
Scam. You're not getting anything out of it. This is how they're wooing you with all this free stuff, but you're going to be paying for it, and you're going to be paying for it with your life.
We hope you've been blessed by watching this teaching of a biblical worldview on socialism. Biblical Worldview is brought to you by Andrew Womack Ministries and Charis Bible College.
When you come to Charis Bible College, you are truly going to experience your life changed.
You will be empowered to minister to your family, to your neighbors, to your church members, to minister, to give the love of Jesus.
We all have a purpose and a destiny, and you will find that out when you attend Charis Bible College.
It's a decision you'll never regret.
It's like I can't speak enough good for Charis.
My life would never, it's just never going to be the same because I went to Charis.
If you want answers to the questions that you have, come here and just dive into His Word.
I knew, okay, I have to be here. There's no doubt in my mind that I have to be here.
I could not recommend Charis Bible College more strongly.
Going to Charis Bible College has changed me and gave me a lot more confidence.
So I believe you should come to Charis Bible College.
I believe you should come to Charis Bible College and you should learn about the unconditional love of God.
It's awesome. I would encourage anyone to take the time to prepare yourself at Charis Bible College.
Sometimes I would find myself saying, Lord, I'm here. I'm here in Colorado. I'm here at Charis. Thank you.